We visited a vast array of places, but I would hesitate to use the word wide access because the entire time our group was accompanied by someone from the Ministry of Friendship Exchange and someone from the official School of Public Health and local authorities at each level. So again, wide exchange is not a moniker that I would use to describe how we were able to interact with people on a professional level. We had several places where we visited, for example, one of the medical universities in Cienfuegos. We had a wonderful panel in exchange with professors there and practitioners and medical students. When we visited a senior care home and a maternal child health home, we were given, you know, wide access to the people there and just, you know, go and talk to people on your own. And having enough Spanish to get by, I was able to do that. It was difficult for people who did not have that facility with Spanish.
Cuba's offered universal health care to its citizens for quite a while. How effective is it?
I would say that there is a level of security among the Cuban people for not having to worry about two things, and that is health care and education, because it's universal and it's free. And so in that sense, they have done an extremely good job. And the way that the universal healthcare system is organized there is based on primary care. Everyone has access to a doctor. Everyone's got a family doctor. And the way that it's structured, it goes from a doctor and nurse team who mimic kind of a community health worker system, who are assigned to a given neighborhood area, and they do home visits, and you come to them, and they're your first line of defense. And if you have something that needs to have extra treatment, they refer you to the polyclinic, and the polyclinic is just that. There are a vast array of services, everything from dental to OBGYN is available there. If you need other specialized services, if you are a woman in an outer province and geography is prohibitive for you, and you need to be on bed rest and monitored through your pregnancy, you are admitted to whatever maternity home is there in your province and then transported by ambulance to the hospital for your birth. All births in Cuba are in a hospital. Now, this sounds lovely and it's great. Here's a couple of caveats, however. All of the medical records are still written by hand.
Not electronic.
There are no electronic medical records. There is very low internet proliferation throughout Cuba. So if you are going from the polyclinic to the maternity clinic, your records are sent by courier, you know, in a taxi cab or however. Whoever's going from that clinic to the hospital takes your records for you. That's very hard. The other thing is, this is where you begin to see impacts of the embargo. Sure, your health care is free. You can go to your doctor, then you go to the polyclinic. You can get something prescribed, and here would be the caveat. It's great that you've got your prescription, but now you've got to go to a pharmacy that actually has the medication you need in stock. By your ration card, monthly items are supposed to be covered. You know, shampoo, toothpaste, a certain amount of baking powder, sanitary products for a woman. But again, one of our Cuban counterparts told us that they hadn't had access to baking powder for like 3 months. And women shared with me that, sure, you know, we can get sanitary products. But, for example, like a box of tampons is $9 in a regular store. And with our ration card, we can go and access our package of sanitary pads each month. But we might spend 4 hours trying to find a store that actually has it in stock.
That is reminiscent of one of the principal arguments that many opponents have of universal health care, at least in this country, or the Affordable Care Act, and that is that it's going to take you a long time to see a doctor when you need to. It's going to take you a long time to arrange surgery if you need it. There's a lot of bureaucratic red tape.
I think every system has it to a greater or lesser degree. Visiting with a nurse in a polyclinic outside of Havana, I think she described it so succinctly. As we were driving on the bus over to this clinic, we noticed that neighborhoods are just beautiful. But you notice that the edifices of these beautiful old historical buildings were crumbling, in need of a paint job. And you couldn't help but notice that because it was everywhere. You know, it's ubiquitous, just like the beautiful cars from the 1950s. They're everywhere. And so during our question and answer time at this clinic, my colleague raised his hand and asked, do you think that Cuba will ever shift its priorities to make infrastructure at the top of the list rather than healthcare or education. And one of the nurses just kind of wrinkled up her nose and looked back at him, and she goes, "Look, if my kids can't read, or if they're sick and I can't get them treatment, why do I need to live in a mansion?"
You work with a refugee community in Clarkston quite a bit and have for a long time.
Yes.
What did you get from the Cuban experience that you can implement back home in DeKalb County?
One of the things I'm really, really excited about, again, was their whole model of primary care and how they took it to the neighborhood level. And so the whole idea of having frontline workers, what we would call in other countries community health workers. And by the way, we do have a semblance of that system in the United States. There are 16 states now, including D.C., that have community health worker programs. And the CDC now, in all of its recommendations for treating chronic conditions, do recommend the inclusion of community health care workers as part of the care team. Why? Because they reduce unnecessary visits to the emergency room. They reduce unnecessary visits to your primary care practitioner. They empower you to be informed consumers. They're your first line of defense, right? That just for me hammered that home more than anything. Last year at the American Public Health Association conference, which was held in New Orleans, the whole theme of the conference was healthography, how where you live affects your health. And there is an entire caucus of the American Public Health Association that is devoted to community health care workers. And there are some wonderful programs across the nation right now that are doing dynamic things. Like here at home in Atlanta, there is a program that Feminist Women's Health Center runs called Lifting Latina Voices Initiative. And they have a whole brigade of promotoras out there. And they have seen wonderful outcomes. And that would be my dream, to impact health not only in greater DeKalb, but for the state of Georgia, for us to really embrace this, because we have some of the worst rates of chronic disease in our nation. We have some of the highest rates of teen pregnancy and teen STDs. And there are many things that we could do, I think, with peer educators, with community health educators. The other thing that community health workers do to help us save money in our healthcare system is that there is the premise that you are who you serve. I don't have to worry about going out and training someone to bring them up to speed on what is culturally competent to talk about, on what the medical terminology would be to talk to a condition to a group of Burmese people or people from Democratic Republic of the Congo. They know that, and they speak the language. So I'm not training people, and I'm not paying for translation either.
So reaching out to the community on a community level, mm-hmm. it really puts the emphasis more on prevention rather than curing something after the fact.
It really does. And it seems that, in my experience, it makes people more empowered for their health care. It's a more educated consumer base. And people trust their gut more. We have a tendency in this country, and I think it overlays in other countries as well, just unquestioningly, we accept whatever a medical provider tells us, right? Or, you know, you will be a chatty Cathy, you know, with your group of friends, with your family. But the minute you get into a healthcare setting, you clam up. You know, your doctor comes in. How are you doing? Fine. You know, you could have spent, you know, all night crying and feeling really depressed and wound up in a ball. But when you get to your doctor's office, you stop talking about it. So I think it fosters a culture of conversation and a commitment to curiosity and asking questions. And it's also built on, interestingly, a premise of relationship. You know, remember the whole thing of, you know, when your doctor used to make house calls. In Cuba, they're still making house calls.
As Americans, many of us perceive of Cuba as an isolated, poor communist dictatorship that's really not involved with the rest of the world, certainly not the developed world, quote unquote, Europe and North America. But the Cuban medical community is really involved on a global basis, isn't it?
Yes, they are. And in fact, anytime there's a disaster, be it a natural disaster or humanitarian disaster, Cuba is one of the first countries to respond. In fact, when I was there and the Nepal earthquake happened, there were teams of Cuban medical professionals, you know, who I heard through the grapevine, you know, like we're garnering up to send a team over right now. It is their greatest resource. In every province in Cuba, there is a medical school. There is a National School of Public Health. You find people from all over the globe. In fact, I believe right now it's 85 countries are represented across the student body of medical schools in Cuba. And that kind of speaks for itself.
I know your foundation, 50 Cents Period, has been involved in Nepal.
Yes.
Before the earthquake. Can you give us an update of how things are going there now?
Yes, we've been involved for almost 5 years now in the Kathmandu Valley and in the Sindhupalchuk region of Nepal. Sindhupalchuk was one of the worst hit during the quake. And when I was in Cuba, I was still out in the Cienfuegos province. And my colleague, Walter, came up to me at breakfast and he said, "I was thinking about you this morning." And being cheeky, I said, "Really? I hope it was good." And he said, "No, it was horrible. In fact, it was the worst." And I was like, "Okay, what happened?" And he said, "There was a quake in Nepal and it's really bad." And I ran to the front desk of the place where we were staying to see if there was any internet, to see if anyone on my team happened to be there. And my colleague Tamara was online, and I asked her if she could just get to Google, get to somewhere where we could see. And I knew the damage was bad, and it was horrible. And just the early pictures out of there were horrendous. And just having traveled there a lot, I knew how mountainous and steep and cavernous that Sindhupalchuk could be. And, you know, it reminded me of being in Rwanda after the genocide and seeing just the topography. And, you know, I was thinking, I'm like, we're never going to know how bad this really was because there are bodies. There are things that we're never going to find. And when I got back to Havana and I was able to get internet, I sent a message on Facebook Messenger to all of my partners there and said, "Just let me know you're okay." And luckily, Google has the safe search thing where it's like, so-and-so is marked safe. And the next time I logged back on, there were people who were being marked safe, but it took several days before all of our team on the ground was accounted for there. And in fact, the 13 schools where we had done research and with whom we were building relationships in Sindhupalchuk are all flattened now.
All 13?
All 13 are gone. Hmm. Right now in Sindhupalchuk, I've been corresponding daily with our partners there, Child Nepal, and we also have a team in the Tamil region of Kathmandu. But in Sindhupalchuk, there's over 10,000 people who are injured. Of the area where our schools are, there's 1,500 dead. In Kathmandu itself, there are people still who have been living outside since the quake. Our teams on the ground now are doing what they can. They are distributing things like tarps for tents, drinking water, you know, clean water, sanitary products, food, medicines, just going to the normal everyday people there who have nowhere else to go. And so we have concentrated, since I have been back, we have been doing some crowdfunding on Facebook to try to build up our fundraising efforts. And the great thing now about the age of technology where we're in, ironically, Nepal has better internet infrastructure than Cuba does. And so we are able to transfer money every few days, either via bank draft or Western Union. And it goes right back to the people. So 100% of anything that we've raised is going right back out to people on the ground in Nepal. And we're in it to win it with our schools there. We don't know what it's going to take or if we will be able to rebuild the 13 that are in Sindhupalchuk. The two that we work with in the Kathmandu Valley, we are committed to being there for whatever the kids and their families need.
If people want to get involved here, what's the best way?
We would love for you to get involved. Please visit our website. A donation in any, and I mean any amount, matters. And it makes a difference to people on the ground. And you can visit our website at 50centsperiod.org. And I should mention that's spelled out. It's 50centsperiod.org.
Lori Lynn King is the founder of 50 Cents Period and the Community Health Director at Clarkson Development Foundation. Ms. King, a pleasure to see you again. Thank you.
You too, Steve. Thank you.